Thanks for listening once again to the Opening Bell podcast, and plenty to get our teeth into this week. It is fight week for Liam Williams taking on Demetrius Andrade stateside. Finally, Williams gets his chance, and the talking has to stop. Plenty of discussion about it. Conor Benn's career so far, a statement win for him last weekend when Shannon Courtney and Ebony Bridges took part in a stirring contest, and a new British woman world champion, Savannah Marshall's also and already that, and once again she put an exclamation point on her talent, and she is going only one way, and that is upwards. So much to talk about, and one of the best fights, shortest fights and most talked about fights as well in history is our This Week in History. Matt's got a good book for you as well, so plenty to get our teeth into. Matthew, Conor Benn, first of all, he couldn't have scripted a better result, nay, a better performance last weekend.
I don't think it was an outlandish kind of prediction that we made last week that Vargas would be quite tricky for Conor Benn. And I kind of still stand by that. I thought that Vargas, if he got into the late rounds, would teach Conor Benn a thing or two. But what Conor Benn did, that unbridled ferocity, when he spotted that one opening and he went for it and he finished it, I thought the finish was exceptionally impressive. I think Conor Benn has now more or less arrived as a fighter in his own right, as opposed to the son of a legend. Still a long way to go, though, isn't there? It's easy to get carried away because he's just marmalised an ageing kind of gatekeeper. What he hasn't done yet is really proved he's the best in this country, in his continent. So there's still a long way to go. There's a long, long way to go. But what I suspect we'll see, rather than the McKinsons, the Crockers, the Avanesians, is that we will see another fight against someone like Vargas. Each different fight has to do different things, and I think that we're probably going to see him in with somebody else who is perhaps approaching the end of their career, but this time we hope that we get him in there with somebody that can give him some rounds.
I think the next step is perhaps one of the most difficult for his handlers and the matchmakers, because you look through the possibilities, all the interesting ones for us are domestically, but you heard Nigel Benn in the build-up to the Formella fight, and particularly afterwards, screaming down the camera, saying, forget about all of them, you just go and do your own thing. And that was the message previously. I think it's only going to be the same message going forward after that as well. And I think Jenkins, McKinson, Lewis Crocker, interesting, Josh Kelly tweeted and threw his name into the mix. Amazing how a defeat can suddenly change your perspective as a fighter, and your needs and your desires, suddenly that can change with one defeat. So Kelly throwing his hat into the ring as well. Avanesian, I think Neil Marsh's promoter was tweeting post-victory for Benn as well, putting Ava's name into the mix as well. I suspect none of those will be considered, Matt, and we have to start scouring for another international opponent. And I was looking through potential names stateside in that regard. A couple that sprung to my mind, Omar Figueroa was one, and Josecito Lopez was the other. Now, they both fought on Fox, so whether those fights could be made. You know, tough name, solid opponents who are beatable. And Jesse Vargas as well, who was supposed to be on the Billy Joe Saunders Canelo undercard, that his fight is off. So he's still looking for a fight. And he has fought on Sky Matchroom bills before. So I think the next step and the next name might be the most significant one in Conor Benn's career, because I wouldn't get too carried away. As good as he looked, and as outstanding a result as that is, I still would want to temper a little bit of enthusiasm getting too carried away. Next step is important. How does it play out?
One of the best things that Nigel Benn did, I think, in his own career, and admittedly he'd had that kind of domestic fight with Michael Watson, he lost that, but one of the best things that he then did is he took himself off to America and he essentially just educated himself. He was fighting guys like Jorge Amparo, Sanderlein Williams, these guys that he knew would give him rounds, and that really took him to the next level, as opposed to kind of playing his trade against domestic level fighters. So you look at the rankings, some interesting names you've just mentioned there. I did exactly the same, actually, and had a look at who's in and around him in the welterweight division. There's Thomas Delorme, perhaps, who would still have ambition, would potentially go the rounds. You could even say Delorme would have a shot of winning that. Luis Collazo, I noticed, called him out, but he's another one. Reliable, can go the rounds. There's Chris Van Heerden, and someone that wouldn't surprise me, but I wouldn't particularly like to see, is someone like an Antonio DeMarco. Very shot-worn, but will... It would be a hell of a statement if he was to stop him. I think we're going to see that. Now, as hardcore boxing fans, what we would like to see is the names that we've already mentioned, the McKinsons, the Crockers and what have you, the Avanesians. How about Yelenusinov, sorry, I was struggling to pronounce his name, but fights like that would be, good grief, they'd be great for the likes of us. But if you are in the Conor Benn business... Why on earth are you going to throw him in with guys like that? What is the ultimate reward for beating guys like that? This is a project now. We're in the midst of a very serious project about building what Matchroom and everyone involved in the Conor Benn business will see. They're in the midst now of building a superstar. Very often we have seen that in this country where fighters won't hang around too long bothering with domestic rivals. They will have their eyes set firmly on the ladder that will take them to the world title fights and to the big money fights.
And the business, and the Conor Benn business, I think is the most important part of that sentence and paragraph that you just spoke. And it was interesting for me, his reaction immediately after that stoppage win, while he was still inside the ring, before anyone had got to him or spoken to him, he turned towards the camera, Matt, and he said, "Pay-per-view, baby." That was the words that came out of his mouth, "Pay-per-view, baby." And then I think shortly after he mentioned Amir Khan. So that's what he's thinking. You can say what we want and what we're thinking, and that's completely immaterial and regardless. What are his handlers and the promotion and TV companies behind him, what are they thinking? You have to build this very, very carefully. His dad was saying Sean Porter straight afterwards, that's a leap I don't think he needs to take right now. But it's a measure of the confidence that his dad has in him. Whether people listening to us agree with that as a step forward right now. And I thought quite a gentlemanly but pointed congratulatory tweet from Amir Khan publicly afterwards, saying well done to Conor Benn, but also reminding him or suggesting in Khan's view that the gap between where Khan has been and where Benn is right now, that perhaps there's some space in the middle. Certainly in Amir's world, and now, of course, he's got his own show on TV with his wife, Meet the Khans, hasn't he? Just recently aired. But Khan has a very clear view of where he fits in. And although it would make good business, I think a Khan v. Benn or a Benn v. Khan fight right here, right now, doesn't really fit with Amir's view of where he fits in the great scheme of things.
No, I'm not. I wouldn't. I don't. I've got no real interest in seeing anything like that. I think that and Kell Brook's name was also mentioned, wasn't he? I wouldn't find those particularly desirable. I think if Amir Khan wants to fight again and Kell Brook wants to fight again, the only logical step is for those two to fight each other. I just think they're so at the wrong ends of their career for someone like Conor Benn. And I don't think that Brook necessarily or even Amir Khan could be paid enough to take what could be quite a sobering and humiliating defeat. I think what you have to say with Conor Benn, you know, I think mentioning Conor Benn's name alongside someone like Sean Porter is balmy at this point, if I'm going to be perfectly honest. I think it's balmy. I don't think he's proved to be anything like that level. But you also have to say, as I tweeted on Saturday night, I remember watching Conor Benn at the start of his career And although I loved the theatre of it when he was with his dad, the savagery that he obviously had, I didn't think for one second that he was going to go much beyond maybe 10 fights. I thought he might be exposed when the first time he stepped up, and he almost was. But the fact that he went in there, not only fought someone like Samuel Vargas, but blitzed him in 80 seconds, I think shows us that we have to take Conor Benn seriously. But there's no need to unleash him against fighters that are in the top 10 at the moment. It's all about that education.
I must admit, I watched back on Vargas's fight with Khan and the build-up to last week. And the one thing that struck me out of that, and I know Khan and Ben have different fighting styles, but the one thing that did strike you about that particular fight was that, and what is that, 3 years ago, nearly 3 years ago, was that Khan stung him repeatedly. And that was around the period where Amir was working with Joe Goosen, wasn't he? It was another period in Amir's career where he had another voice in his corner telling him another set of things that they wanted him to work on. And I think had Amir gone about his business as usual, the times, and they were frequent through that fight where he stung Vargas, had he gone with a barrage of punches like he normally does, Amir, I came away thinking he would have stopped Vargas that night. And I went into the weekend and king of the aftertimers, I didn't mention it on the pod last week, but that was what I was thinking in my mind, was that a kind of flurry of activity like that would be the thing to undo Vargas. And it was a more powerful flurry of activity that really did unearth him very, very quickly. Mind you, he did fight Virgil Ortiz just last year, and it took Ortiz seven rounds to dispatch him. But I've never been a fan of A beats B, so B beats C, and all of that kind of that sort of tangential relative mathematical thinking about how boxing matches can unfold. But it was pretty spectacular nonetheless. I'm just wondering, the fact that, you know, he's so impressive, Ben, I think, in terms of the way he thinks and talks about the business, and the way he's grafted so hard. As you said, it's 2017, 2018. He had those two very, very different fights with Cedric Penault. But the fact that out of his mouth, the names Amir Khan and then Adrian Broner, those were the two names that were on his mind. And that kind of hints towards him thinking about the business of boxing and the biggest money fights. Is that fair?
I think it's absolutely fair, and I think that Conor Benn will identify that Amir Khan certainly is not the force he was. He's nowhere like the force he was. I think if you look at the fight he had against Terence Crawford, even if you take away the controversial stoppage at the end, is that Amir Khan was showing all the signs of an aging fighter who should perhaps be thinking about retirement. And you don't even have to look at his hands, just look at his feet. Just look at his feet throughout that fight for the biggest telltale sign that Amir Khan is slipping. Adrian Broner, when was the last time Adrian Broner won a meaningful fight? So he's picking out guys that he knows are at pay-per-view level and he knows are beatable for him at the moment. He's not calling out the guys that we would like to see him call out. He is being very, very intelligent with the manner in which he looks to build his career. We spoke to Tony Sims, his trainer. John Dennon spoke to Tony Sims, his trainer, yesterday for an article in this week's Boxing News. And Tony is very, very keen to keep making baby steps. He'd like to see Conor Benn back out in July, but not against any of these names that are being kind of bandied about at the moment. He just, as we have said, he wants that education to continue, and he sees absolutely no point in rushing it. Now, Conor Benn, only 24 years old, there's no need to rush him. And this is Tony Sims, who's been in with the gym winner, who will have seen those rough edges being slowly but surely sanded down over the years. But if Tony Sims isn't saying, yeah, let him off the leash now, then I don't think you're going to see anything like some of the names that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I'm most impressed with Ben, the way he talks. And he's perfectly willing to acknowledge, which I think is a change in the last few months, that the fact that he is an improved fighter. I think he took that as a slight previously, almost suggesting that he was no good before and now he's a bit better. And it's a huge compliment from where he was 2017, 2018 against Cedric Pano to where he is now. It's a huge compliment to how hard he's worked and how diligent he's gone about it. But he's terrifically honest, isn't he? There's sound bites left, right and centre from him. I think for you as an editor and a journalist, he is an absolute dream. For us all as broadcasters, he is a dream. And there's a real raw, refreshing honesty about everything that he says right now. He is most impressive. And therefore, I think needs to be very, very appropriately and thoughtfully moved. The next step has to be the key one. I think Colazzo's a great shout for me, Matt. That might be one of the likelier names we've put forward.
Someone like that would make all the sense. You mentioned the Pianord fight there when he was on the way up, and he needed that kind of fight. The fact that he got through that, even though it was at a much lower level, but the fact that he got through that, I do remember thinking then, that is a guy with some serious balls to get up and do what he did at that level. He now perhaps needs a similar fight, a comparative jump for this level. Just some. What he needs now is rounds, but he needs some competitive rounds. Formella didn't perhaps provide those competitive rounds. It's perfectly understandable why people would have thought that Vargas would have been able to provide those rounds. Now he needs someone who can give him those rounds. And I think Collazo would make sense. Delorme would make sense, but perhaps he might be seen as being a little bit young, a little bit cute, a little bit clever. Chris Van Heerden, any of those, something along those lines would make perfect sense for Conor Benn next.
And if you needed any contrast, it's only in the contrast context, let me say, and perspective. We've had Virgil Ortiz, who's one of the best kind of prospects around in the welterweight division, beating Maurice Hooker just a few weeks ago. He's already right up there in the rankings for a title shot. And also at the weekend, you had Jerron Ennis, a Philly fighter. Philadelphia have something to really shout about now, Matt. He's put in another stoppage defeat at the weekend. Six rounds he went through Sergei Lipinets, who you remember has only lost to Mikey Garcia previously, beat Lamont Peterson. He's a fighter with really strong credentials, former IBF champion down at 140 pounds. And he was stopped in six in a terrific fight at the weekend by Jerron Ennis, who now has 25 stoppages in 27 wins. And I tell you what, you close your eyes and then you open them again and watch him. He's not straight out of Philly, straight out of Compton. He is straight out of Sheffield. you could put him in the Brendan Ingle gym up there. Dominic Ingle gym. We'll be speaking about Dominic, of course, and Liam Willis in due course later in the pod. But you could put him straight in at Winkerbank and he wouldn't be out of place, that guy.
He's versatile. He's impressive. I hear exactly what you're saying. I'd never thought of it that way. I think one of the biggest compliments we can give to Boots Ennis is that Nigel Collins, who is one of my favourite ever boxing writers, former editor of The Ring, currently writes for us. He does some great stuff for us, and he actually did the report from this fight. He's hot on Ennis, and bear in mind that Nigel Collins has been in and around boxing since the 1970s and seen some of the great Philly fighters up close. He's from Philadelphia, so it's difficult to make the comparison from watching that fight where it went a few rounds to Conor Benn, who took care of business in 80 seconds, but I think really Ennis does appear to be far more advanced than Conor Benn at this point. Something that I saw somebody tweet not so long ago is that the welterweight division, historically, it's been such a wonderful division, a hotbed of talent throughout history. But are we reaching the end of kind of the Terence Crawford, Errol Spence kind of era? Are they almost talking themselves out of it? Is this now ready for the young guns to kind of come along and take over this division? And Ennis is one of those fighters who is on the cusp. We talked about Ortiz before. There's a lot of young fighters just on the edges. it'd be nice to see some of them start to fight each other and teach the leaders a thing or two about what should be done, wouldn't it?
Absolutely right. Well, Porter, Thurm and Danny Garcia, they had a sort of mini round robin, but nowhere near as much as it should have been. And of course, Terence Crawford, either by his own designs and demands or because of his relationship with Top Rank, he just hasn't been in the fights that he should have been in. Talk of him and Pacquiao in early June still in the clouds. But yeah, wouldn't it be great if this next gen, this next sequence of young, talented 147-pound fighters actually got involved in the big fights together? We look forward to how that unfolds. Let's talk about the other fights on that bill. There were a tremendous performance from Savannah Marshall and a terrific fight ultimately and thankfully between Shannon Courtenay and Ebony Bridges. After all of the build-up, Matt, and the spat about selling yourself, promoting yourself, earning some money and the woman's game, and what all of that means and the relationship or the friction between the two. After all of that, how good it was that we just got a good old-fashioned dust-up. And what a fight it was.
Superb fight. Really, really enjoyed it. I must admit, going into it, I was a little bit concerned about the whole thing, to be honest. I thought that it was teetering on... not necessarily being a good advertisement for women's boxing. It kind of took me back a little bit to conversations I'd had with Mia St. John, where she used to say that she was rolled out on Top Rank on undercards as kind of the token eye candy. It brought me back to that way of thinking a little bit. But what we had was a wonderful fight with, I had nothing but genuine admiration for the effort of both fighters. Bridges fought those last 6 minutes, sorry, the last 4 minutes with the eye in that state. I was expecting it to be stopped, actually. She couldn't see a thing out of that. Now, to go through that amount of time without being able to see, and ultimately those rounds, one could argue, was what made the difference in the end. Or it did to many observers. I know the scorecards were quite generous, I thought, to Courtenay. But that is the kind of fight, the kind of well-matched fight that women's boxing needs. And to draw the interest in and for people to see that kind of thing, that's exactly what women's boxing has to do, is to have well-matched fights. I've seen kind of there was a few eyebrows raised, although I did notice that Eddie Hearn stayed completely still. He didn't dare move during the weigh-in, dare move his eyes or anything like that when Ebony Bridges was stood there in her lingerie. And, you know, I was kind of edging towards that point of view a second ago, wasn't I, saying, is that really the way that we want to see women's boxing being presented? But for anybody that's saying that's offensive, that's surely better than two male boxers spitting at each other, brawling, throwing tables or whatever. There's that drew eyes onto the sport. And then when the fight delivered, that was the really, really important thing. What it didn't need any way at all was a world title attached to it. It just didn't need the world title attached to it. That didn't draw in any extra viewers whatsoever. I don't want to appear like I'm being negative or anything like that, but if there had been two men elevated to that position to fight for a vacant world title of comparative experience, then we'd be up in arms about it. We'd be criticising the WBA for saying, how dare they? And if you go back and you look, Ebony Bridges suddenly appeared, not after a fight, but suddenly appeared in the WBA rankings last year. She came in at ninth place in the WBA rankings. A couple of months ago, when this fight with Shannon Courtenay was announced, Courtenay then appears at number 8 in the WBA rankings, previously not ranked in the top 15. Then they say that that's going to be for the vacant WBA title. That isn't how it should work. I'm sorry, it's not how it should work. So what's the takeaway? What's the takeaway from Saturday's fight? What is the takeaway from that? Is it that you go and you knuckle down in the gym, you learn your trade, you start at the bottom and you work your way up? Or is it you work really hard on the social media kind of things and you get as many followers as possible and then you might just get a world title shot? I think if we're being honest, in the 2021, and we can, this is a really deep and wide issue, isn't it? Really, really deep. This isn't just about women's boxing. This is about boxing in general. We can point this to male fighters getting opportunities they don't deserve. But more and more, if you've got the numbers, you can bring in the numbers. And how many times do we hear that with the numbers? That you're going to get rewarded. That doesn't mean though that they need to throw a world title fight at it. For me, I'm not pleased with that. I don't like that, and I'm not criticizing either of the fighters for that. What I'm criticizing is the WBA and perhaps the people that lobbied the WBA to get that sanctioned.
Yeah, a manipulation of the rankings that effectively, either by those sanctioning bodies, aided and abetted by those behind the scenes. And yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think there are a layer of points behind the fact that it just was a great fight. The battle of position in the build-up to the fight between Courtney, who was saying that Bridges, in her view, exploiting her sex and her sexuality for financial gain, when someone like Katie Taylor has been a trailblazer for the sport, and you know the sport, women's boxing, is grasping for a position in the scheme of things, and Courtney was dismayed by Bridges. I didn't have an issue with it personally. I didn't have a view on it one way or t'other. It did get me thinking about over the weekend, because obviously Rachel Blackmore, who's been one of the big stories in the horse racing world, for those that don't know, I present for Racing TV, both on screen and at the racetracks in my other walk of life. So obviously I've followed Blackmore's story. She had half a dozen winners at the Cheltenham Festival. She was the leading jockey at the Cheltenham Festival. Now, horse racing is different from most other sports in that men and women can compete in the same race on even terms for the same prize money. That is something of an exception in the sporting world, and it's a rare thing indeed, and horse racing should be banging that drum perhaps more than it is. And the way Blackmore dominated the Cheltenham Festival was reminiscent of what Ruby Walsh was doing in his pomp, and not something that's done all that often, having that number of winners at the Cheltenham Festival. And it got me thinking, because Blackmore has very much been the kind of sports person who wants her ability to do her talking. She does interviews, but she's not particularly comfortable with it. And I must admit, as a racing fan and as a journalist or broadcaster, I have just hoped a few times, and I hoped again on Saturday, that she might have just said in a post-race interview, to win the Grand National, the first woman to do that. It's an extraordinary story. But I wanted her, Matt, just to say once, and only once, words to this effect, if I can just inspire one little girl from Donegal, then that's great. That's great. And I just wanted her to say something like that, but it's just not her way. In the same way, we have boxers who are not comfortable with interviews, other jockeys, Ryan Moore, who's not necessarily comfortable doing interviews. It's just not her way. She wants her talking to be done on the track in the same way that there are some fighters who want to do their boxing in the ring. And thankfully, it was the fighting that did the talking at the weekend, and that sort of spat in the build-up that didn't really come to bear. So where are we with this as a fight, and this as an inspiration for other female fighters and for the sport going forward? Because you've made a point about this being a world title fight, Matt. We are going to get women having 5-6, in the case of Shannon Courtney, 7 fights before this getting a world title. Ebony Bridges, just the five fights. Because of the lack of strength and depth, because it is a new sport, because effectively women's boxing is right now a third world country, and that's not an insult to say that. That's just the truth about it's a new sport. Nicol Adams only got to the Olympics in 2012 for the first time. That's how little time has passed and how much has happened in a relatively short space of time. So where are we at with the game and where are we going forward?
There's loads and loads of... You can't downplay how much progress has been made in the last few years. You're absolutely right. We're right at the beginning. So as a consequence of that, we will have, I suppose, world champions that people that are familiar with the men's game may look at the level that the women are fighting at and say, how on earth are they world champions, without being condescending or anything like that, because they are right at the beginning. I suppose my point really with Courtney and Bridges is that they were both almost magicked into the world rankings. It's not like they're the only... If they were the only two bantamweights on the planet, or there was just a handful of them, but they're not. There's over 100 bantamweights in the world. There was 15 female bantamweights ranked prior to Bridges suddenly finding herself in the rankings without winning a fight, and without Courtney finding herself inserted into the rankings without winning a fight. So it's not like they're the only two. But I accept that it has to start somewhere. You look at some of the titles, the WBC middleweight title, for example, has only been contested once, and that was when Clarissa Shields won it. It has got to start somewhere. It has got to start somewhere. But I still believe that there are certain standards that should be met before people fight for world titles. Just because we're at the start, still doesn't need it. It doesn't need to be easy. I think it's an insult. I suppose the best way I could put it is I think it's an insult to other fighters that have been performing at certain levels or have been fighting at a higher level that have been overlooked for titles simply because they haven't got the profile that Courtney and Bridges have got. And that's, I suppose, as bluntly as I can put it, with wanting as also to be exceptionally respectful for the efforts that those two women put forth on Saturday night, because it was an awe-inspiring effort. And I would like to say there's no way on this planet that you or I could ever, ever do anything like that. They are as superhuman in my eyes as the men that I've admired over the years are. I have nothing but respect for that. But we don't... This trend of just throwing world title fights at fights that just don't need a world title fight, to my mind, is just... It won't do the sport any favours in the long run. You go back, and I know it's a different, wholly different trade and a wholly different time. Mickey Ward and Arturo Gatti had three wonderful fights over 10 rounds. Not one of those fights was for a world title, nor did it need to be. It just downplays the importance, it dilutes the importance of the world title when they're just almost attached onto these events as like something as a souvenir. It doesn't need it. But we are in an era at the moment where not every female title fight can be at elite level. Not every female title fight can be well matched. I mean, I'll bring you now to a fight that takes place this weekend. Hannah Gabriels takes on someone who has lost four out of their last five, knocked out in a round in her last fight, which was well over a year ago, for a vacant WBA light heavyweight title. It's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. But then it goes back to what you were saying. Well, is that simply because there isn't anybody else there for her to fight? It's a difficult situation, but let's not get too hung up, as the men have, with this world title culture. I said it on the podcast, perhaps when we were talking to Hannah Rankin, that what the women's game has got, it's almost got a clean slate, in that you will see more undisputed champions. There isn't as much red tape to go through to get the fights that we want to see. But let's not just create world titles for the sake of it, just to put on a fight poster or to add a little bit of dazzle to a social media post or whatever. It's not the way that the sport. It's not the way that the sport has been built over the years, and it to me it just downgrades what is and what should be. I hasten to add, what should be the greatest achievement in boxing is to win that world title.
I think that's very fair. It's okay to praise and give context. It's okay to put forward one argument and balance it with another. And just as we were wowed by the grit, the effort, the will and the determination of both Courtney and Ebony Bridges, it's also okay to say that in truth, that was a fight that was lacking in technique and in terms of, you know, talent at a certain level. It's okay to put that in perspective and say that it was lacking, and maybe that's a bit of a comment on, you know, the sport and where it's going to. It's also okay to say, and why I mentioned in the racing world what Rachel Blackmore is doing right now, because she is just recognized as a jockey, and the discussion in the racing world has already moved on from her being a lady jockey. It's still a story out in the wider domain, but in the racing world she's just considered a jockey. And you know, I was speaking to a pal of mine yesterday whose young daughter, you know, she's 6 or 7, she's horse mad. She goes he takes her up to ride a rented pony every single weekend. And Rachel Blackmore is now her idol, in the same way that probably Katie Taylor has been for Shannon Courtney and many other boxers as well. And maybe now Shannon Courtney is going to be a bit of a hero, a heroine for other young would-be women sportsmen. And that's the great thing. If you're a young girl, young lady right now, whatever your sport is, there are becoming flag bearers. That are becoming those that are giving you something to dream about, are putting on performances that make you wish you were them. And that's a great place to be in whatever capacity. Just a quick word on Savannah Marshall, because she was too big, too good, hit too hard for Maria Lindberg. I felt a bit sorry for Lindberg. You knew after about 20 seconds that she really was out of her depth and shouldn't be in there at the age of 44. But I mean, she had gone the distance with Christina Hammer twice. She'd gone the distance with Takare, who most recently lost on points to Clarissa Shields as well. So she had done her yards and was, I suppose, a viable last minute substitution and opponent, Matt. What it did was provide us with more context about where Marshall is compared to most of the rest.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't particularly have a massive problem with that fight. I'm not sure what else they could have done in order to ensure that Savannah Marshall had a fight for a world title at that level. I mean, it highlights that the talent pool isn't that deep. Whereas when a man drops out, there's so many more fighters to choose from, isn't there? Because it's been around for so much longer. So there's far more fighters to choose from where you can bring in someone. I thought Lindberg, yeah, she went in with ambition. She had credentials, obviously well past her peak. But the fact that Marshall took her out of there like that, you can't say that's not impressive. That was highly impressive. It's quite rare for in the 2 minute rounds for stoppages to occur like that. And I thought, you know, when Lindberg went down, particularly for the when she was counted out at the start of the count, she was more or less saying, "I'm not going to get up." She was shaking her head. "I don't know. No, it's fine." It's midway through the count. "No, I'm not going to get up. Just wave it. I am absolutely done." Savannah Marshall is elite level. She needs the kind of competition that I suspect in and around her weight class that Clarissa Shields is one of the only who can give her that fight. That is the fight. But we need the fights like Courtney and Bridges that just bubbling under to be occurring, the well-matched fights to be occurring just below elite level. But at elite level, as any sport needs, not just boxing, the best need to be matched against the best. And Shields versus Marshall is a mouth-watering matchup, whichever way you look at it.
It is. I think Marshall could well be the alongside Katie Taylor, probably the best boxer in women's boxing right now, and she certainly, I think, punches the hardest as well, particularly, I think, more so than Clarissa Shields. That is the biggest fight. It's probably the only test around for Savannah Marshall right now. I don't subscribe to the notion that that is an easy night for Marshall. I think Clarissa Shields' speed creates real problems for Marshall. I think speed could be a big weapon in that fight, should it ever take place for Clarissa Shields. But Marshall does things that I don't think any other boxer, including Katie Taylor, does right now. She, to be honest, when she was moving, floating around a bit through that first round, I was thinking she kind of looked a bit like the female Tyson Fury, to be honest. And that might sound like ridiculous praise, but I do think she has the potential to be that good. I don't think the tests are going to come in her lifetime, Matt. I think the problem for her is going to be staying motivated enough to set yourself your own challenges, and that will probably be number of defenses, probably going up to super middle and winning a title there. She's going to, if she can't get the Clarissa Shields fight, she's going to have to test herself one way or another.
Absolutely. And that, it kind of goes back to what you were saying at the start, in that we are at the very, very start of this journey, and we only have to go back to the 1890s. The 1900s and 1910s of some of the kind of trailblazing gloved male champions. There were some very, very dominant, very gifted, and some of these guys are now still held up as some of the greatest of all time. But if you go back and you dissect their records, they just didn't have the competition at that time. They were head and shoulders above the rest, which is why it's so important for Marshall, if there is someone out there, to provide the test that she deserves and the spectacle that women's boxing deserves, then that everybody involved moves heaven and earth to make that fight happen.
Time now to talk about Liam Williams' big fight, big chance. Finally, it's upon him and us this weekend as he takes on Demetrius Andrade for the WBO middleweight title. Andrade defending that for the fourth time, having been, of course, a world champion at 154 pounds as well. Before we talk about it, let's hear from Liam Williams, who earlier on this week, on Monday, I think it was, caught up with Matt, or Matt caught up with him. And the first question he asked him was, given the jet lag and the travelling, how he was catching up and how he was getting on with all of that.
To be honest with you, I am a lot better now. I would say I'm probably 80% there.
Right.
Which is, you know, that's good, because in the next 2 days, by Wednesday, I reckon I'll be 100% with it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not far off now. I'm feeling fairly good in myself, to be fair. It's just a case of, you know, in the afternoon, I do get a bit burnt out, kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I know the feeling well. What time is your ring walk? It's a bit earlier than normal for an American fight, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they've slightly adjusted it for to kind of provide a better opportunity for the British fans. So it's going to be around, I think it's going to be like 11 o'clock.
Nice. So that'd be kind of normal then, won't it?
Yeah, all they're saying 11 o'clock, but that maybe, they say first bell is 11 o'clock.
Okay, oh, I see. So,
give or take, they're about sure.
So what? What's it like out there? What's your impressions of it?
Yeah, it's really nice, mate. I'm enjoying myself. I can only obviously enjoy myself to a certain extent because of, when it comes to the crunch, I'm here to do a job, and I, so... it's not going to be all fun and games, it's not a jolly, but it's just one of them where you just have to keep focused and just enjoy it and take it for what it is.
I've read a few interviews that you've done, and you seem exceptionally confident. Is that still the case now as it gets closer and closer? Is that confidence growing?
Yeah, of course it is, mate, even more so. I literally can't wait, mate. I'm excited for the opportunity, and I feel like this is not my coming out party, because, you know, people kind of know where I am now, but on the world stage, and, you know, on the massive stage, especially in America, I think this is my big opportunity to shine.
You say it's not your coming out party, but there's still some people, particularly in America, that don't really fancy your chances, whereas people over here in the UK, there's a lot of belief in this, that even if they're not picking you, they know it's going to be a very, very hard fight for Andrade. Do you feel like you've got a lot to prove?
Do you know what? In a way, yeah. But on the other hand, I don't have to prove anything to anybody. I couldn't give a fuck what people think. And if they write to me off, and, you know, that's even better. I want them to write me off because, you know, hopefully he'll overlook me and he'll have the shock of his life.
I read an interview that you did with Dewey Powell, and he was talking about you've kind of been studying Andrade, like, almost obsessively. While you've been doing that, what is the one thing or a couple of things that worry you the most about him when you'll be facing him in the ring?
Nothing at all worries me, if I'm being totally honest with you. Obviously, I have to respect him, his ability and everything else. But I don't fear him one, you know, in the slightest. So it's just a case of me staying focused, you know, respecting his ability and what he does good and what he does bad, and just going about what I have to do, you know?
Yeah.
I know that's a bit of a shit answer, to be honest with you. No, but that is kind of the top and bottom of it, really. It's not. I know what he can do. He's obviously very good. He's awkward and whatever else, but it's more of a case of, you know, me just adapting to that and making sure I do what I need to do on the night.
Have you been aware of his talents for a long time? Because he's kind of been the next big thing for quite a long time, but still not quite got there, has he?
Yeah, do you know, I've said this in an interview before, and I've been not a bit of a fan, but, like, I've always taken note of him and realised his ability and that he's good and stuff, you know. I always have, from even way back when the likes of Brian Rose boxed him.
Yeah.
And I've always thought, well, yeah, you know, this guy's very good. But, you know, he is good. He does some things very good, but I do think he's very sloppy in other areas too, and we have picked up quite a few things where I feel like I could exploit him, you know.
Absolutely. Your kind of almost reinvention since you've moved up in weight has been so impressive in recent years. What is the secret behind that?
Do you know, mate, there is no secret. There's just it's just hard work, commitment and dedication. You know, I've just really focused myself and almost put my life on hold in many ways, just to bring myself back to the top and where I know I should be and need to be.
You say you've put your life on hold. You've got your family at home. You've got a child on the way. Just for people that don't dedicate themselves to something like you've dedicated yourself to boxing, just try and explain how difficult that is.
Well, you know, it's not easy because when I'm training, I'm in Sheffield. I I'm 4 hours away from where I live, 240 miles or whatever it is. And as we said, it's not easy, but you know, when you want something, if you want it that bad, you'll do whatever it takes. And that's what I've done. I move there 5 days a week. I do miss people, you know. I miss my little girl, my missus, just family in general. But you know, it's, I believe to be the best and be where you want to be, you have to make sacrifices to appreciate the benefits and everything else, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd finished all, you, because you got out there on last Tuesday. What have you been doing in terms of your training, in terms of your ticking over while you've been out there?
So up until Friday, Saturday, we was doing some decent sessions, just making sure we're adjusting and all that. But like, obviously it's Monday now, it's 5 week. I've done some bits this morning, a bit of pad work and whatnot. Probably the same again tomorrow, in terms of just staying sharp, a bit of skipping, shadow pads, just a kind of like an hour's work, but not solid rounds. You know, like just tip tapping the pads and moving and working on a couple of little things as well.
Does it?
So we'll probably do that again tomorrow, and that'll be it, pretty much.
Is there much media over there? Are you having to deal with all that? Because I always imagine for a fighter in fight week, it's the last thing you want to do. Is there many people over there that you're having to talk to on a daily basis?
Not really at the moment, to be honest with you. But it is only Monday, so it will get a bit more intense. But yeah, it's just one of them. You know, I'm used to it now. It's part of the job, really, isn't it? So I'm cheating some yogurt. it can be a bit of a pain in the ass. You know, it's not really what you want to be doing when you're tired and hungry and whatever. So, but it's just one of them. You do get used to it, and you know, I'm just enjoying I'm enjoying my big moment and sucking it all up, because I'm pretty confident there's going to be a lot more weeks and, you know, there's going to be a lot more of these occasions in front of me.
And just before I let you go, and I do appreciate your time, we've been going back and forth a bit this week and kept missing each other, so I really appreciate this. But just while you've been studying Andrade and kind of really drilling down into his style, how do you envision the fight going on Saturday night?
I think it could be a tricky fight for a certain amount of time. It depends, really, because you do tend to see a bit of a pattern of him coming out for the first bell, flying, you know, trying to put people in their place a little bit. But I don't really think I'm not set up my mind on anything. I'm just kind of open to either option, but I feel like he's going to come out and have a feel around, because I don't feel like he's going to want to come and bring that all-out attack to me in the first round, because he knows that I'm dangerous and he could run onto something. But I just think he's going to try and fiddle around and try and win the first couple by boxing and moving. You know, when it comes to crunch, I just think I'm going to have too much for him. You know, even if he does come out awkward, pickpocketing and trying to burn me out a little bit, I just think I'm going to catch up with him, and I'm going to start bashing him.
That's brilliant. Listen, I really appreciate your time. It's really appreciated, particularly with just so close to your fight, and I wish you all the very best, Liam. I know a lot of people at home will share that view as well.
Yeah, 100%. Thank you, mate. No problem.
Well, Matt, it sounds like he's nearly there, and I think by the time this podcast is out, he might be fully attuned and acclimated to that kind of long distance travel and settling into to fight week. He sounds like he's in a good place, Williams. He's so enjoyable to follow both in and out of the ring. I do sense though that this is a big task ahead of him this weekend in every way.
It's a huge task for him. Demetrius Andrade, we know, is of okay. You say I was about to say he's a formidable force, but then when I was writing the preview, and I've written an in-depth 4-page preview on this fight for this week's Boxing News, you drill down into Andrade's record, and he hasn't really beaten anybody that should put the fear into Liam Williams. We've known about Andrade since 2006, 2007, when he was an amateur. 2008, he was tipped to win a gold medal. He ended up going out in the quarterfinals at welterweight. And then prior to him winning his first world belt, which was the WBO 154-pound belt, which he beat when he beat Vanes Martirosyan over 12 rounds on a split decision. Prior to that, he was one of the brightest stars. He was a superstar in waiting. Hasn't quite worked out that way. He's been operating in and around world titles since then, since 2000, I think it was 2013. But he's only had 9 fights in that time. He's picked up a WBA secondary title, and he's also obviously won this WBO belt at middleweight. But there isn't a bona fide top 5 guy on his record. There isn't. He's so talented. He's so talented. He's so hard to hit. And that, for me, is the most difficult thing. And I think if we're going to be brutally honest, he appears the more versatile of the two. But I must say, just in closing on this, I must say, as I was writing it, I've just got this nagging, or, you know, it might turn out to be the best feeling in the world. I've just got this feeling that Liam Williams is going to do it. But if you look at all the evidence, and you kind of keep, and I have to keep I have to keep level-headed when writing previews for Boxing News, that if you just look at all the evidence and look at the fights, and spent a long time looking at both of their recent fights, that the evidence would point to Andrade winning this contest. But honestly, I've got such a feeling that Liam Williams could do it.
Yeah, it is a difficult one. I mean, as you say, you look at Andrade, and he would never quite know how we're supposed to pronounce it. You look at his record. I mean, against Luke Keeler, who's probably maybe a couple of levels but behind Liam Williams. It's probably fair to say. I've commentated on quite a few of Luke Keeler's fights, and he hit Keeler with just about everything, and it took him 9 rounds to get rid of Keeler. Prior to that, you know, the points win over Suletsky, the late stoppage of Akhovov. He's not beating stellar opponents. It's style over substance, I think, is what you're saying with Andrade. And then Liam Williams, as good as he's looked, 7 consecutive knockouts since he lost to Liam Smith for the second time. But those have all been, bar Atlantis Fox, and we'll come to that particular performance, but bar that, he's been beating British-level opponents at best, guys who really he should be walking through. Now he has, and he's been looking spectacular, and he is full of the business right now. But I suppose that the Atlantis Fox performance in late 2019, that is the one that draws you both on paper and indeed collaterally in terms of the way Fox fought against Andrade, where he went the distance, and against Williams afterwards, where he was mauled in 5 rounds. And of course, Fox, 6 foot plus, very tall, lanky middleweight as well, presented problems in that regard for Williams, who came forward single-handedly all night, but was out jabbing him on that occasion, following it with the right hand very quickly after the jab. That was a technical thing that I think worked for him and may be crucial again if he's to get success from Andrade. But Andrade's footwork and movement is miles better than Fox's. So there's so many strands. You can have a ledger of positives and then a ledger of question marks for both fighters, Matt. I think it's fair to say.
I think it is completely fair to say, and I make that point as well in the in the preview. And I think if we have just spent, or rather I have just spent 10 minutes on my soapbox kind of bemoaning the fact that there was a world title attached to Courtney and Bridges, if you're going to strip this down to its bare bones, we've got a fight here parading as a world middleweight title fight where neither of the fighters involved have won a fight, you could argue, against anybody in the top 10. That's a symptom of the game at the moment, unfortunately, but it shouldn't detract from what an intriguing fight this is. And you're right, there's so many things you can look at. I looked at that Fox fight against Andrade and the Fox fight against Williams, and the manner in which Williams went about his business should tell anybody that he's not just this one-dimensional kind of slugger that some people kind of write him off as. You also even go back even further and look at the first Liam Smith fight, and he was so in that fight. There was large periods of that where he's completely in control of Liam Smith. The fact that Liam Smith then deservedly won the return over 12 rounds should only highlight for me not the limitations of Liam Williams, but what a very good fighter Liam Smith is. But you're right. But what Liam Williams has done at middleweight under the guidance of Dominic Ingle, which he touched upon in the interview, is he said that he's now taken himself off. He's now working with Dominic Ingle. He's not at home in Wales anymore. He's 240 miles away, and he has just dedicated himself to boxing like he has never done before. He believes in himself as much as any kind of rank outsider possibly could. There is not, when he says he has got nothing to fear in Andrade, when he says he's watched him and he's been obsessing over him, he's been watching fights 5-6 nights a week, there's nothing there that bothers him. He's well aware that he's a good fighter, but there's nothing there that he feels he can't deal with. I suppose the difficult thing for me is can Williams do as much as what he's good at? Will Andrade allow him to do as much of what he's good at to have success? And I'm not convinced that he will. Also, the fact that this is away from home. I don't think the time difference will make one iota of difference, but the fact that he is just away from home might make a difference. But you can't... I could just see Williams breaking through. We're about due. One of these great British wins on American soil. And for me, this isn't one of those Mission Impossibles. The headline that I used, in fact, was Mission Possible. This isn't one of those where you kind of mention the British challengers' chances in passing. You feel you have to out of politeness, but there's not any real conviction. When I say that Liam Williams has got a really good chance of winning this fight, I mean it. I'm so invested in his chances in this fight. But then you go back to Andrade, don't you? You go back to Andrade and what he is good at. And he never looks spectacular. You mentioned the Luke Keeler fight there, but then Luke Keeler gave him half an inch in the first 20 seconds and the slingshot left hand came in and he's on his backside. Andrade will punish any mistakes that Liam Williams makes. But Liam Williams, even if he's not winning rounds, this could be the crucial thing. So if it's kind of slipping away from him rounds 4 and 5, he's just somehow got to make it clear to Andrade that he's still in that fight. He's got to take chances, even when it may appear that Andrade is at a safe distance. I can't wait for it. I really, really can't wait to watch this one.
I think Liam Williams has to get his tactics absolutely spot on. It's worth remembering against Mark Heffron, he did box against Heffron. It won't necessarily just be the come forward performance that we saw against Atlantis Fox. I think it might have to be a combination. He's going to have to be very, very smart, Williams, but he can't afford to give Andrade too much space. And we know that Andrade has got the skills maybe to walk him onto an uppercut, to move off to the side. He's got the footwork to do all of that. And it's worth remembering as well, in that Atlantis Fox fight in the second round, Fox really did stun Liam Williams very briefly with a sharp right hand. And he can't afford to be caught in between distances, Liam Williams. He's got to get his tactics spot on. It's a big ask. I'm leaning towards Andrade on points. How about you?
Yeah, that's kind of my official prediction, if you like, Andrade on points. Yeah, I mean, what I would say, if you like a flutter and you can afford to to have a flutter, is just have a look at the odds on Liam Williams winning in the second half. I think he's something like, I think he's 9-4 in most UK markets just to win. And then it starts to get a bit more enticing if you start looking at the stoppage win, and you start looking at the stoppage win in certain sections of the fight. But yeah, if I was going to put Little Rocky's life on it, I would have to side with the champion, unfortunately, to win what might be quite an untidy but always competitive fight on the judges' scorecards.
Time now for This Week in History. And this week, we take you back to the 15th of April, 1985. Marvin Hagler against Tommy Hearns. Only lasted three rounds. The first round, just unmitigated violence inside that first 3 minutes. Probably the best round in boxing history. Certainly some of the most action in boxing history as well. 15,000 at Caesar's Palace enjoying it in Mad. Actually, if you look at the second and third rounds, and I'm sure people have again and again and again, they just couldn't share the same frenetic force and energy of the first 3 minutes. Actually, things do settle down. And the most notable thing for me is that Tommy Hearns' legs through the second and then even worse into the third rounds are just absolutely gone. And it's difficult to believe that it was just the force of punches and the effort of that first round. It seems almost impossible to think that he would just fall apart so quickly in that regard, which sort of lends credence to the whole massage prior to the fight, a discussion as well. But what a first round, Matt. You could watch that again and again and again. Certainly one for anybody's rainy day list.
It's an absolute glorious first round. And it's just, it's hard to believe when you watch that first round again that this was the fight of 1985. This was the super fight of 1985. Gosh, to just dispense with the feeling out process just went hell for leather. I'm often asked, which fight would you like to have been ringside for? And this is right up there. This is right up there on the wish list. But I also think, how on earth, particularly as a print journalist, where you're having to make notes, how on earth do you make notes on the action? When you go back to your hotel room afterwards, or you have to go back and sit at ringside and write the report, and you're not blessed with replays, or you're not blessed with just checking your phone and looking on YouTube or looking at other things and facts and figures, how on earth would you go about giving a blow by blow of that first round? It was insane, insane action. And as you say, if it wasn't the best round of all time, it is the best first round of all time. It's astonishing. And comparatively, when I was watching this a couple of years ago, or whenever it was, when I went back and studied this in detail for something in Boxing News, rounds two and three suddenly look like the most overrated rounds in history when you compare it to that first one. Round two and three, a load of rubbish compared to what happened in those first 3 minutes. Astonishing way to start the fight.
Yeah, there's a great line with about half a minute to go in that first round from Al Michaels, who was commentating on ABC Sports. And he said, half a minute to go in round one. How far can this go? Already preempting that it wouldn't be a long distance night. And funny enough, I was asked that exact same question just yesterday by a boxing pal of mine, saying, if you could go ringside to any fight in history, what would it be? And although this sprung to mind partly because of the first round, partly because it's fame, and partly because we were going to do it in the podcast this week, it did spring to mind. But I thought, unless I would choose a fight of greater length, just so that I could savor it. And being over in three rounds, I'd kind of almost want a stellar undercard to go along with it, just to really enjoy the experience. So I think I said probably have to be Ali, Foreman and Zaire would be right towards the top of the list. Maybe the fight in 71. Maybe you would have thrown in Leonard against Hagler. I don't. I suspect it would be Zaire in 74 would be the answer to that particular question. But the action in that first round, it was amazing because people thought maybe Hagler would come out and try and box Hearns, who, of course, had been champion at 154 pounds, talking about who deserves their chance and whether the very first fight in middleweight, whether he was entitled to go straight into a fight at that weight with someone like Marvin Hagler. But the first round, Hagler threw to wild right hands in the first 20 seconds. And then, of course, he walked onto a huge uppercut off the ropes from Tommy Hearns. There's a big gash across his forehead, across his eye as well. That cut's been described as various things, but it looked like he'd been cut open with a can, I think was one of them that I read. And then things settle down a little and Hagler just breaks down Hearns bit by bit. Probably the most significant win of Hagler's career, would you say?
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be. The manner in which he finished Thomas Hearns in round three, where he's more or less running after him, is perhaps the seek and destroy Marvin Hagler moment. And Thomas Hearns was the favourite going into that fight. We'd seen Thomas Hearns Polax Roberto Duran, the same Roberto Duran who not so long before went 15 very hard rounds with Marvin Hagler, and I suppose that's where people were kind of drawing their conclusion. Hagler had been notoriously chasing just a shot at the world title, the world middleweight title, for so long that when he got there, it then took him a little while to... He had Roberto Duran in 83, but it did... The super fights didn't flow as perhaps we might presume they did, unless you look back and you look back carefully. But this was his moment. This was his moment where he announced himself as one of the greatest middleweights in history.
The unfurl, a huge US flag over the Caesars Hotel as well. It covers about 15 floors or thereabouts from top to bottom. Guess who was one of the ringside judges that night as well, 14 years on from refereeing Cooper against Buckner, Harry Gibbs was sitting at ringside. There wouldn't be any controversy about Harry's scorecard on that night, as there was in our previous fight of the week, Cooper against Buckner from 1971. And Richard Steele was the referee. He was kind of the man of the moment, Richard Steele, wasn't he? You look at some of the fights that Richard Steele reffed during that particular period. Meldrick Taylor against Chavez, famously stopping that with seconds to go with Taylor up on the scorecards in 1990. The year before, Tyson Bruno won. He'd been the man in the middle for that as well. The year after, he was in between Barry McGuigan and Steve Cruz in the heat of Las Vegas as well. A year later, he'd be in between Hagler and Leonard. Of course, 2 years later, I should say, it'd be Mugabe, who was in the ring against Hagler 1 year later. Much later, it'd be Mayweather against Zab Judah and Roy Jones Jr. against James Toney as well. Just a few of the notable fights that Richard Steele was in the ring. And there's one more, which is going to lead me on to our book of the week, Matt, unless you've got a final line on Hagler Hearns.
I've got a final line on Richard Steele. You mentioned all those fights there. In an interview we conducted with Richard Steele, we asked him, you know, what was the best fight? What was the most exciting fight? And he said that the most violent fight that he'd ever refereed, almost bringing us back round to the very start of the podcast, was a certain Chris Eubank against Nigel Benn. That was the first one. He said that was the most dramatic and most violent fight that he was ever involved in. I think people who watch this Hearns and Hagler fight might have something to say about that. But of course, Steele always had a pretty good view of the fights he was involved in.
Yes, we did that in a fight of the week, didn't we, a few months back, and that was a brutal, non-stop, brutal, hard fight. Eubank coming out on top, but split, cut, lip, blood coming from, and just pain etched across his face. The post-fight interview where he's not absolutely with it, but just so delighted to come out on top and so respectful of what Nigel Benn had put him through. And another fight that Richard Steele was the man in the middle for was 2 years earlier, and it was Aaron Pryor against Alexis Arguello too, which segues nicely into our book of the week. And it's over to you, Matthew, your choice this week.
Yeah, I was having a little dig around in the books, and one that I had forgotten, which is one of my favourite boxing books. It's not that readily available, actually. Is Flight of the Hawk, the Aaron Pryor story. And we've talked about Marvin Hagler for obvious reasons a lot over the last few weeks. We've talked about Sugar Ray Leonard, Thomas Hearns, Roberto Duran. We talk about Mike Tyson from the 1980s. I think one of the fighters that perhaps doesn't get the appreciation that he should, who's a little bit unfortunate in many ways, made a lot of mistakes as well, of course, is the one and only Aaron the Hawk Pryor. Such a intoxicating competitor at his peak. This book is fascinating for many reasons. It was published in 1996, when I think by then he had kicked his infamous drug habit. This will take you through the highs of Aaron Pryor's roller coaster boxing career and life, but it takes you down into the depths of his lows in a way that not many boxing books do. It is astonishing the detail that he goes into about his drug addiction, how it started with his then wife. He kind of blames his then wife Teresa for handing him a crack pipe for the first time. He talks about that in detail, and then just how he ended, more or less ended up on the street. Occasionally clawing himself back into boxing just to earn some money, and telling all around him that he'd kicked this habit, when the truth of the matter was that he was just trying to raise enough cash so he could go on his next bender. And yeah, it's quite a harrowing read. But prior to that, you do get the detailed accounts of his fights. He talks about the first Arguello fight, which of course for me is one of the best fights of all time, one of the best of the 1980s, tarnished somewhat by that infamous the bottle that I mixed from Panama Lewis that he asked for prior to the 14th round, when Aaron Pryor went out and won that fight. And he talks about how he feels that his name was tarnished forever, really, as a consequence of that. He goes into detail about what was in the bottle, or what he claimed was in that bottle. There's various other people. It's not just all first person with Aaron Pryor. There's various other people that are interviewed and are spoken to, that kind of intersperse within Aaron Pryor's recollections. It's a brilliant read. Although the bad news, I guess, is that I did look yesterday to see how available it was, and I noticed that you can probably pick one up for about £80. On eBay, but if you do manage to get your hands on it, I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, it might have to be borrowed. I think there was one for £100 on Amazon as well. So yeah, they are prized possessions. Matt's very lucky. I don't have one yet. I might have to borrow his sooner rather than later. But it's an amazing story. And those two fights with Arguello, we'll have to feature those on this week in history's sole defeat, of course, just the one defeat in those 40 fights to Bobby Joe Young, who's a fellow Cincinnati fighter, came after 2 years plus out of the ring, where, as Matt said, he'd been on the pipe, not inside the ring. So just extraordinary record. And the big fights eluded him. I mean, that alone might have kind of driven him to drink and drugs. You know, 80, 81, Sugar Ray Leonard, Duran, both of those fights were mooted. I think he turned them both down for one reason or another. He did sign to fight Leonard in 82, but then the detached retina forged another of Leonard's retirements. And he just, Ray Mancini as well, I think he was supposed to fight in 84, and that was another one. I think Mancini lost to Livingston Bramble, and that was another fight that kind of went by the wayside as well. So all of the big fights really eluded him. All of those big names and huge paydays eluded him for one reason or another throughout his career, and that's sort of woven into his story. And one of the things I love, you know me, Matt, I love clobber and I love ring walks. And his clobber for the Arguello fights in particular are just otherworldly. Talk about sort of retro 70s, sort of black with the gold and red and white diamond links into them, almost like trim, are just works of art. If I could get my hands on that robe or shorts or a copy of that, I would be a happy, happy man. So some of the best ring garb I think I've ever seen, Adam Pryor, no doubt about it. Died, what, 5 years ago, 2016, thereabouts?
2016, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. If you could get your hands on that garb, if you could get your hands on that clobber, I would be even happier if I could accompany you on a night out while you were wearing them.
I actually would go clubbing in his,
I know you would.
Shorts or the ring robe, not a problem at all. The late Aaron Pryor, then, remembered by Matt this week with Flight of the Hawk, the Aaron Pryor story. Whether any of us can get our hands on that one day, we will have to wait and see. Right, that's just about it. Plenty going on this weekend, of course. I'm commentating up in Bolton, Danny Dignam and others in action there. He could be really putting his name on the British middleweight scene this year. And I think Regis Progray is back in action, isn't he, against Evan Redcatch. And your pal Jake Paul in action on that same bill, Matt, Triller, of course. So maybe we'll be reporting on how the numbers go and whether that's going to be a future development. More of that kind of theme, isn't it? Marcus Maidana's talking about getting back in the ring at the age of 37, having been out for 7 years. And Holyfield against Kevin McBride seems like that's going to happen as well. I almost can't believe some of the talk right now.
No, well, you know, it's kind of started now. We're in it, aren't we? We're in it, and I think it's a horrible trend, if I'm honest with you. But I think that I can't imagine. I think the world of Evander Holyfield, both as a man and as a fighter. But I can't imagine that Holyfield McBride is going to be anything other than a truly horrible spectacle. So I guess we can hope that may put an end to it, but I doubt it. I doubt it. It's given license to all of these fighters now that kind of begrudgingly accept that they can't do it anymore, to give it another go. It's become what was once so unacceptable has, in the space of 6 months since Mike Tyson came back and fought Roy Jones Jr., become completely the opposite in the eyes of some.
Well, really, it's Mayweather's fault, isn't it? It's Mayweather McGregor. It's that's what's kick-started this whole scene, and it's been pushed further down the track by Roy Jones Jr. and Mike Tyson, I'm afraid. So the story's going to run and run unless something terrible happens, and it's just unmanageable right now. That's the problem. It is unmanageable. Right, let's finish on a bright note. Good luck to Liam Williams. Enjoy all of the action this weekend, and we'll be back to talk about it again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.